Hey, what's going on? Welcome to the Mile High Five podcast. I'm Doug Cunnington, and I have my friend Mark in with me today. How are you?
I'm doing awesome. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. It's Friday when we're recording this, and a weird thing, you know, Elizabeth stopped working about 10 months ago, 11 months ago. Most days feel like a Friday or a weekend now. How does that work for you?
I was actually surprised. I was like, oh, it is Friday. You're right. I don't even know what day of the week it is most of the time. So now I know it's Friday.
So today we're going to talk about a question that we got in. Should we pay off a mortgage? And these folks have a mortgage that's at 2.5%. So from the intro, you could tell me and Mark, we're completely out of touch. We're like, we don't even know what day it is.
Why are you asking us questions?
So we have some details here. And I think this is going to be a great exercise because Mark, you recently bought a home. Do you have a mortgage right now?
No.
Okay. And we bought this house, Elizabeth and I, 5 years ago. We do have a mortgage. We don't have as sweet of a rate as 2.5%, but it's at 3.25, something like that. So we didn't get it at the bottom. And I mean, honestly, we're like, this is a great rate. We should not pay it off. This is a pretty cheap loan. But occasionally we think, should we pay this off? And we actually know a lot of friends in our community around here that have paid off their home and others that are like, I'm not going to pay it off because it's such a good rate. So we're going to talk about that today.
Yeah. And I was in a similar situation on my prior home. I had a mortgage that I did refinance when rates went down and it was 2.75%. So I have seen kind of both sides of the coin, I guess you would say.
Very good. So we're going to go through some of the overall financial details. I'm going to try to read this almost verbatim. And if people want to look a little bit deeper, I actually put this on a webpage. So we'll put the link in the show notes if people want to review it a little bit closer. And I'm just going to read it here. So we'll call them Jen or Jennifer for, you know, anonymity. Is that how you say that word?
Yes. I'm not going to repeat it because I'll probably screw it up.
And I always get scared right before I say it. Okay. Well, I'm going to try to read here. So I'm 47 and my husband is 48. They have a mortgage on their primary residence of $273,000. And the value is about $1.3 million. They have a rental property, and that mortgage is $458,000. The value is about $950,000. They have investments saved between a 401k, a TSP, that is a thrift savings plan, and a brokerage account, and that totals about $2.2 million. There's no other debt besides the mortgage. They have 529s for their two kids. They're fully funded at $160,000. The husband's income is $235,000. They would like to retire in 8 to 10 years. My husband still likes to work and has some professional goals. My income as a real estate agent is variable and it's hard to estimate. Currently, she's paying herself $5,000 per month. And half of that goes into the 401k. The other half makes it so they could pay their bills each month when combined with her husband's income. If I stop working, then we can't cover all the bills because the husband's income is not enough. But if they pay off the mortgage, they'll be able to do that. And it would take the pressure off of her. And she mentions that my job is stressful. And after 20 years, she's kind of over it. So she'll probably do something in some capacity, but basically she's a little burned out. So wrapping it up here, she says, my thought is that if we make about $500,000 on the rental sale, we could take $273,000 and pay off the primary mortgage and invest the balance, which is approximately $227,000. So they're totally conflicted. They have a 2.5% mortgage and they're not sure what to do. So Mark, it's good to have you here because you went through this and you had a cheap mortgage, yet you don't have one now. And before we get into like the details of the question, why did you buy your home outright in this case?
Well, rates today, if anyone is familiar, around 7%. So what was interesting about my home purchase is that I could have borrowed the money, although I don't know that anyone would lend it to me because I don't have a job. So that would have been the first hurdle. And I had enough equity from the sale of my previous home to buy outright, so that wasn't a concern. I didn't have to have a mortgage. I had plenty of money to pay for the house in full. The mortgage rates were around 7% at the time. Now, the home was being sold by a builder, and to entice people to buy these homes, they were buying down rates. So I could have gotten a mortgage at 4.99%, which sounds kind of enticing. But I said to them, and they didn't say this outright, but I asked, I was like, now, if you're buying these mortgages down, you have to pay something to do that. If I pay cash, what will you do for me? And they said, oh, well, we'll go to the lender and see, or the agent, I guess you would say, for the builder said, I will talk to, you know, the bosses and find out what the story is, and I'll come back to you on that. They came back and they said, well, we can give you $15,000 off the price of the house. And I was like, I'll take that, no problem, because I really don't want a 4.99% mortgage or a 7% mortgage, but I'll take the 15 grand off the price of the house. So it was even more of a reason to not finance.
Got it. Very, very good. And from a psychological perspective, like a lot of people mention when they pay off their mortgage, they just feel more comfortable and they sleep better at night. Do you experience anything like that?
You know, I thought that might be the case, but not really, because you still have the regular expenses. You're just not paying the principal and interest, but you're still paying your property taxes, which are usually pretty significant, your homeowner's insurance, which a lot of people don't realize, or maybe they do, but just don't think about it, is often wrapped up in your mortgage because you're escrowing for it. So even if, let's say you have a mortgage and you're escrowing, that entire payment's not going to go away if you pay it off. You're still going to have to pay those property taxes and the insurance, and the escrow basically allows you to pay it over on a monthly basis instead of when the bill is due. Actually, I just walked to the mailbox today. My bill was in there. Now I have already paid it, but they realized that they sent it to the wrong place. They sent it to the builder. But it's a big number. And, you know, I'm paying it in, you know, we can either pay it in full or we can pay it in two pieces, but it's still two large chunks rather than paying it monthly. So I think a lot of people think if I pay my mortgage off, I'm going to have no payment. That's not necessarily the case if you're escrowing.
Mm-hmm. And quick note, Jennifer here noted that they're in the DC-ish area. And basically, I think even if the mortgage is paid off, it's still about $1,000 for insurance and taxes and whatever else they may have to pay, HOA stuff perhaps.
So you're still going to have to figure out how to do that. Yeah. Correct. So it's not going to like absolve you of all costs. Yeah.
So this is an interesting question because like, I think most people know that if they're looking at a mortgage that's 2.5% versus like investing the money, they're thinking, okay, if we're optimizing for maximum returns, like clearly we don't pay off the mortgage, we invest the money, and that's better. But it's more complicated than that, I think. So, Mark, I sent this over, and I'm just curious your initial thoughts. I'm going to let you, you know, get into your details here.
Yeah. So, I like to, when I read a question like this, I kind of really like to parse it down into what is the real core question here. And the real question is, you know, in essence, what is the goal? And the goal is eliminate the mortgage payment and ease cash flow burden. That's really the goal here. So I like to think of it, and coming back to your question of, you know, do you keep the mortgage? Do you not keep the mortgage? What do you do? I like to parse it down to, let's just go through a mental exercise. So I'm going to ask you a question. If you could plant a tree in the backyard and it produced $100 bills every week, and you didn't have to water it, you didn't have to do anything, you just had to plant it, would you want that tree?
Yeah, that sounds good.
Right. Pretty good, right? So effectively, that's the question here. And there's a way to do that. Now, there's one question is, if you don't pay the mortgage off, what are you going to do with the money, right? Now, if you were to put it in stocks, people would say, oh, but you know, the stock market on average goes up 10% a year, blah, blah, blah. And the difference is 7.5%. Why wouldn't you do that? The problem is there's volatility risk. And as we know, if you just look at the market, this is being recorded on, I don't know, what are we, March 6th or 7th here? Mm-hmm. The market's been down, you know, 8% in the last, you know, couple of weeks. That's not a guaranteed return. But if you look at interest rates today in like a money market account, and I just looked up the Vanguard, you know, federal money market account, which is kind of the settlement fund in Vanguard brokerage accounts, it's yielding 4.25%. So if we look at, we could take this money and invest it very conservatively with no risk in a money market account at 4.25 and borrow it in essence at 2.5, it boils down to about $100 a week, or about $4,800 a year, actually, in spread. So why wouldn't you take that deal? It's the same as planting the $100 per week tree in your backyard. Now, the other side of the coin is paying off that mortgage has an emotional benefit, right? And I was in this exact situation. So I had, in my previous home, we had refinanced, I think we owed 100 and change. It was not a lot of money or relative to the value of the home, just like them. They have a lot of equity in their home. So this isn't like, you know, they're borrowing 80% of the value of the home, for instance. It's a nominal amount relative to the equity in the home. And what I decided to do was I said, well, I could just pay it off because I had the cash to do it. Or again, kind of I'm a compartmentalizer, I could open a separate account, put that exact amount of money in there, have the bill, the principal and interest at least portion, the mortgage piece of it, paid directly from that account and just let it run. So I've solved my question of improving cash flow because now this account is taking care of that, not me writing the check or worrying about having income to pay this. It's effectively like it's off balance sheet. You've got this liability over here, which is the mortgage, and you've got this asset over here, which is the money market account, let's say. Set it up as an entirely separate account, pay the mortgage directly from that on auto pay, and just let it go. And your money tree is in process. Now, what happened? And then someone will say, well, what if rates drop? Well, if rates drop, you just take the balance out of the account and pay it off. The rates would have to drop to less than 2.5% to make you want to do that. I would say that's probably very unlikely that we will see rates drop to 2.5%. But if they do, just there'll be plenty of balance. You just let that account kind of continue to compound with that money tree sitting in that account and just let it go. And you've solved your cash flow worry and you're making the spread in the meantime. So it's kind of a relatively simple solution. And it's also a way to kind of put it all off to the side and not have to think about it.
Okay. Very good. And just to restate a little bit, so they're selling their rental and then they're taking the money, and to address the volatility of the overall market where we're thinking of 8 to 10% returns, for example, you put it into a money market
account. Well, just the amount that the mortgage amount of it. So they were talking about netting around $500.
Yeah,
just the $273 equivalent to the mortgage. So basically, you've got these two accounts kind of running simultaneously. You've got this liability account and you've got this asset account. And initially, you fund them with this, you know, you fund it with the same amount. And because you're earning more than you're paying out on the other side, that account, that spread is going to widen over time.
Okay. Got it.
But the other amount, I'm not going to give advice on what they should do. They can do whatever they want, whatever the goals are.
Right, right. And none of this is advice, by the way.
Right.
This is entertainment. Okay. Are there any, so there's the one risk of like if rates change, if they drop, then the math gets a little, you know, troublesome. Are there any other downsides that you could think of?
Well, there is, you know, obviously you're going to have to monitor this account and that it's being paid. And I would say that if they're, and I would say that what I think is interesting is that I think the, what was the home value around 1.3 or something like that, and the mortgage is 220 or 273. So they may not be escrowing now anyway. But if they are escrowing, you kind of got to have to pull those two apart and do them, you know, potentially separately. So you're paying your interest and, I mean, your property taxes and your insurance separate from this kind of money tree account.
Sure.
So you do have to pull those apart. If you did want to, now what I actually did was I overfunded that account beyond what my mortgage was. And I said to myself at the time, I was like, I probably won't be in this house more than 5 or 6 years or whatever. I actually kind of pre-funded all of those costs, the insurance and the taxes, into that account. And so it was actually paying all of those things. And it truly did get it kind of off my books.
Interesting.
So that was, again, compartmentalizer. So I like to do that. So that was a way to kind of say, I don't even have to worry about my property taxes. It just comes out of that account. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter if it's lumpy.
Got it. Interesting. Okay. I love it. We kind of looked at it differently. So that, because I didn't even think about doing that exactly. Although I did chat with Elizabeth because I was like, oh yeah, I got a cool question. And she mentioned something similar, but she was just like,
yeah, I'm very curious because I know you two are kind of opposed in the way that you think about things, or not in a negative way, but just right. You think differently. So I'm curious what your solution would be and what her solution would be.
So initially, she was just like, put the money, or not initially, she was just like, she could just have the money invested and then like pull off what she needs to make the cash flow work and like start drawing down basically. And I was like, oh yeah, that makes sense. It doesn't address the potential volatility, sequence of returns, issues that you may run into. But overall, I mean, you know, if they're looking at 8 to 10 years, like usually over that span, like you're okay, but not always, unless you're not, right? Before I give my answer, I will tell people that I had my sort of gut feeling, and then I also asked AI, which I'll get into some yes. details, because I'm lazy, as you know. So I was like, I think I got the answer, but I could go to Gemini is what I used.
So you fed this whole thing in there to see what it said?
Yep. Oh. And it's kind of cool because it really quantifies, similar to what you have done, but it quantifies. And I'll go through it again. I'll put this on a webpage so people can look and see like the actual chart, because it really spells it out. Before we do that, we do have a sponsor today, and that is GhostBed. I have the GhostBed Lux, and it has like this nice cooling layer in there. Many mattresses have layers, but this has cooling technology in there, and it helps me sleep nice and cool. Very important to me. I'm trying to remember, we have the bed up there. Did you lay on it?
No, I have not done that. I did not sneak in your room and lay on your bed. Sorry.
I saw you go in there. I don't know why you went in there, but so very happy that GhostBed is working with us. They have a full range of products, by the way. So they have like adjustable bed bases, and they have pillows and sheets and many different kinds of mattresses. In fact, sometimes it's confusing like what mattress you should get, but they have a 3-minute sleep quiz that you could take, which we'll put a link for that. And you just take the quiz, ask you a handful of questions, but you don't have to worry about it because there's a 101 night at home sleep trial. So you could test it out and make sure it works for you. And I know we'll talk to you later, but you can save 50%. I know you're outfitting your house now. I don't know if you have the extra mattress yet, but if you want to have your guests sleep really well, get a GhostBed in there.
All right.
So you could save 50% out there. Go to ghostbed.com/milehighfi. That's site-wide, by the way. All right. I looked at this a little bit differently. So number one, I had the gut feeling that it would be okay without looking at any numbers, like understanding that if you pay off the mortgage, it's a 2.5% gain automatically. That's guaranteed. And the thing we're looking at is the opportunity cost of investing it and probably getting like an 8% return. I think a lot of people use 8%. So right off the bat, is that 6.5? 5.5?
5.5.
5.5. Never do math live. So 5.5% right there, which is kind of a significant amount of money. But then I also thought, we're not just trying to optimize on returns. They have a great foundation. They had this rental place. They're going to sell it. Like, they made some good money, I think. And I thought it was going to be okay to give up like whatever those returns are. And the thing you know, we're like, oh, 5% and compound interest and blah, blah, blah. Like it's a huge amount of money. But the thing that Jim and I did much quicker than I could have done it was to actually quantify over 8 to 10 years and look at how much they would benefit monetarily, like quantify it exactly. If they pay off the mortgage, it's a certain amount of money. And if they don't pay off the mortgage and they invest it, how much is that?
I'm very curious to hear what the Gemini's rate return assumption is.
So it's pretty smart. I did use Gemini Advanced 2.0 Flash Thinking Experimental. So this actually shows its work and it tells you the thought processes. So it gave us a range. It was like, we'll look at 5%, 7%, and 9% return. So it gave us a little window. And this is all on the webpage, but basically I'll just tell you the 10-year mark. So it's $68,250 saved on mortgage interest in over the 10-year period.
So if you pay it off.
If you pay it off.
Okay.
So that's the benefit. 68K. So that's the benchmark. And if you look at the 5% point, it's $171,500, which is a net benefit if you're looking at a 5%, which is pretty low, but that's $103,000.
I'm curious though, because you don't actually have the $273,000 the whole 10 years because you are paying it down. So what I don't know is is that just like taking the difference of what 273 times 2.5% interest would be, but you're not paying 2.5% interest on the whole 273 because it's declining over time because you are paying off. And that was the other thing in the question. We actually don't know what the term left of this loan is. So we don't know if there's only 5 years left in this loan. Is there, you know, 15 years left? So again, these numbers aren't going to be 100% accurate because all the factors aren't there.
Great point. I didn't think of that. The AI is very smart, but I'm not sure if they took that into account. But what, before I read off like the other
bottom
line.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but that was one of my thought processes because the money tree, $100 eventually is going to be $90, going to be $80,
$60. Interesting. I think it probably took that into account because of the level of detail that it went into, but I'm not 100% sure. The interesting part, like overall, like we're dialing in to exactly what the opportunity cost is in a quantified way. Yeah. And then we're going to talk about the qualitative issues
does
that you run into.
Address that?
It does. Yeah. Oh, it gives you pros and cons of everything here. But with that said, even if it fucked up that portion that you're talking about, where it's like, is it taking into account, which I think it did. I think we're probably still like 90% of whatever our real answer is, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah, totally.
Yeah. So it's like, we can split
unless there was only like 2 years left in the mortgage. That would be the only difference.
But, right. Yeah. It's hard to say, but right. I think you're right. Okay. So continuing on. So again, we're comparing 10 years, $68K is the mortgage amount saved. So it's 7%. That would be $261K. And the net benefit of investing would be about $200,000. So it's $192K. And then if the returns were about 9%, that's $356K. The net benefit of investing, if the returns were 9%, would be $287K. So just to pick the one in the middle here, we'll say it is the 7% and it's about $200,000. So now what we're looking at is they're giving up $200,000 in return, but we have to look at things a little higher level. So $200K is a lot. But currently, their approximated net worth based on the information that they provided here is about $3.8 million. So even right now, $200K is not like, we don't want to throw it away, right? But $200K is only about 5% of their overall net worth, like right now, current value. If you look further ahead, maybe it won't be that much. But what we're really looking at is like less stress, lifestyle choices, working less, and are you willing to give up $200K, just 5% of your net worth, for feeling better, getting better sleep, and just having like a happier life. And I think that's a great trade.
Yeah, that's why I don't really like the 7% number, because I always kind of look at the worst case scenario, I guess you would say. And so let's say today you could pay your mortgage off. This 273 and, you know, life is good, no more payment. But you say, I'm going to invest it in equities or whatever, even a 60-40 portfolio or anything semi-conservative, and it goes down in the first 2 months. How do you feel? Most people are going to be like, I should have just paid it off.
Yeah.
So that's why I don't like the higher rates of return. Right. I like to say, if you're going to do this, find the most secure way to make the spread so you can eliminate that concern that inevitably would happen to me if I did it, right? The market or whatever would go down. So that's why in my analysis, I just chose a pure plain vanilla money market, could be a CD, could be whatever, but, you know, kind of principal protected investment for that spread and not even go for anything above that.
And again, it's always more complicated. I knew we're like, this is a pretty straightforward question, but like at the same time, there's a lot of nuance. And it's like the biggest thing that people buy, right? It's like a house. So huge amount. So you're describing limiting the downside.
Yeah. Eliminating the downside, really.
Okay. And in that case, obviously, you limit the upside because you're in a tighter range, but you're not going to lose
money. And you're giving up spread. I mean, potentially, you're giving up, you know, let's say you can buy a money market at 4.25% right now.
Yeah.
And you maybe over 10 years, you know, there's a high probability that maybe you could get 7%, but you're giving up that uncertainty for the surety of a given return that's lower, but removing that obstacle of, well, what if it doesn't go to 7%? What if it goes down?
Right. So in that case, like as we're describing this, I feel like even people that are like, oh yeah, you wouldn't want to pay it off. Like I guess it depends on what people's goals are, right? It's like, do you want to maximize your returns or do you want to have flexibility and then time, maybe a little time freedom.
Talking about flexibility, that's a good point too. And that was something I was thinking about. If you pay the mortgage off, where does that equity go? It goes from a liquid investment account to an illiquid asset in the form of equity in your primary home. That's very difficult to tap, especially if she said she was potentially going to leave her job. What if she wanted to start a business and needed some capital? And now it's all tied up in the home. Now, they have plenty of other resources, but I'm thinking kind of in other scenarios.
Right.
Having this, let's say, money tree investment account or money market account gives you that access that you could get to it if you needed to, whereas if you paid the mortgage off, it's going to be much harder to get to it.
Also a good point.
So you've added flexibility with no real downside.
Gotcha. And it's good because a lot of times when people send in questions, you could reach me, Doug@milehighfi.com. Well, traditionally in the past, it would take me forever to get an answer back on an actual show. So what I often do is I'll write back a quicker answer. And I'm, you know, I think people know I'm not like a financial expert, but I have seen more scenarios and people just want to bounce ideas.
You play one on TV, so.
Yeah. I pretend like I'm a doctor. So I actually provided, you know, my gut feeling. I sent back, you know, some of the analysis from Gemini, which provided some good information, but your solution is in the middle and it limits the downside risk while taking advantage of like some higher returns and opportunities. So it's cool that we went through this because like it's not like you pay it off or you don't pay it off and don't invest it. It's like you could do a little bit of both. And I think that kind of that blends it together. You're very smart, Mark. That's why I asked you here.
Well, it's funny that I recall back in those days when I was refinancing, because I was like, well, I could just pay this off and just be done with it. And I chose to refinance because I was like, why wouldn't you take money at, you know, sub 3%, which if you look at the long-term, you know, history of inflation, it's around 3.2. So if you can borrow at a rate below inflation, you should do it, you know, hand over fist. And actually, Warren Buffett commented on that during the time and said, I would borrow as much as I can at 2% today and lock it in for 30 years if they would let me. Yeah. Because he was just like, the spread is just too obvious. And you just match it with short-term treasuries or, you know, money market. And it's like a no-brainer money tree. Why would you not do it? But to go further out on the risk curve, that's a whole different story. And I think that's what most people in the FI community think of is like, well, I'll just put it in VTSAX and I'll make the spread. Well, that's not a guaranteed spread. Doing something like matching it with treasuries or money market, that's pretty much a guaranteed spread. Mm-hmm. And I'd rather take the guaranteed spread that's something than this uncertain, potentially much higher spread that we don't know if it'll happen or not.
It's interesting.
I mean, reverse it, right?
Right.
Turn it around and say, if you didn't have this mortgage, would you go borrow at 2.5% and invest it in XYZ?
Oh, that's cool.
Right.
That's
a smart way. So turn it around.
Yeah.
Invert it. That's what Charlie Munger used to say, always invert. So turn it around and say, if I didn't have this mortgage, would I go borrow it today at 2.5%, lock it in for whatever the term of this mortgage is going forward? And what could I do with it? And I would say, if you would lend me at 2.5% right now, I would borrow as much as I can and just match it with an asset that is guaranteed or effectively guaranteed and take that spread all day. But I wouldn't go out on the risk curve. I would not borrow at any rate to, you know, invest in equities, let's say.
Okay. And like you said, that's what most people are thinking of. And the, you know, sort of our audience and me and the FIRE community, you know, it's been fantastic market returns over the last, well, like 15 plus years.
Yeah, it's been phenomenal. Actually, I was going to come out with an episode talking about it because so many people are worried about it. And I agree. Prices are very high right now.
Yeah. And you're a couple years older than me. You're about to turn 50. Is that
60.
Right?
60.
So, but the thing is, like, you were around when international stocks were doing better and you've seen some like bigger recessions and stuff like that. How much do you think that whatever, just the recency bias in our community where we're like, just put it in VTSAX or VTI and like, we don't need to do anything else. And, you know, you have a background in finance. So you're like, we should limit the downside. We have to look at this. It's not always going to be good. So kind of an open question about recency bias for equities.
Yeah, it's very interesting because I really didn't think about this much until recently because I do own Berkshire Hathaway. It's the only stock I've owned. It's not a, you know, I'm not giving advice or anything like that. I just happen to own it. And so I pay very close attention to what, you know, Berkshire Hathaway is doing. And they have, in essence, sold a lot of their portfolio. And just because they have not had a lot of new opportunities, the cash on the balance sheet is about $324 billion, which is about 30% of the value of the company right now. And it was interesting because they came out with the annual report, or he wrote the annual report that just was released last week. And I thought he would say something about it, but he basically just said, no, he didn't really touch it too much, but valuations are very high right now. And that doesn't mean don't buy stocks or sell all your stocks or anything like that, but just be aware that valuations, when they are high, there's a higher probability that there'll be some volatility in the market going forward. And anytime there's uncertainty, that's a reason for volatility. And certainly there's been a lot of uncertainty recently. And then I was thinking about, well, when was the last time we really had a major market correction? Well, there was one during COVID, but it was like, if you sneezed, you didn't see it. You know, it was so brief. I don't really count that as a major correction, but the 2000 kind of 2008-2009 period was. But that's quite a long time ago now. I don't think of it as a long time ago. But if you think about it, that's, 15 years ago. There's a lot of people that have only been investing after that period of time and haven't seen a true market decline. Everyone's like, oh, yeah, but COVID. I'm like, that doesn't count. It was so quick. 2008-2009 was this long, slow drip, and it just took forever to kind of get through it. And that was the same in the late 90s. I went through that too. And even the early 90s, same thing. But the internet bubble at the end of 99, no one remembers that. I mean, I remember it pretty distinctly. But we just haven't had a major kind of slow, long decline in the market, and they happen. And, you know, we can say it as long as we want, you know, oh, it's you know, going to happen at some point. But for the people that have been investing in the last decade, they haven't seen it. So they don't really, until you experience it, you don't really know what it's like.
Yeah. And I, even though I look so young, I do remember the late 90s because I was interning and I was at Nortel Networks. Remember that company?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they gave us like the employee stock purchase plan and had some great benefits and all that stuff. And yeah, for the whatever first few terms or the year or so that I was working with them, I like did really well on those because I would get the discount and then I would like sell them right away. And I was like, this is awesome. This is like fantastic. Good amount of money for me and everything.
Well, at least you sold them and didn't hold them.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Because it dropped. Like we got laid off as, because it was like literally like I started in like 98. Yeah, like I think by 2000, I had to find another gig. But do you happen to remember, and I was trying to look it up and it'll take me a second, but how much did the market, let's say like the S&P drop in 2008 to 2009?
I think it was almost like 50%.
Right.
But it wasn't like it happened overnight. It was a slow decline. It's almost like, what is it, the Chinese water torture or whatever you say, you know, just another week and it's down again and again and again and again. And it's funny, I hear people talking about it a little bit in social media now, like over the last couple of weeks, the market has been down. I'm like, this is not a major decline. This is just a very, but this is the first thing that some people have experienced, especially if they're in kind of the Magnificent Seven that have had some big drops. But they've also, unless they bought it very, very recently, or probably not down personally, but it's down from the peak, but not down from maybe what you paid for it. It's when you have these very slow, long declines where it's week after week, month after month, that it just kind of like drains you.
Right.
We have not seen that in decades.
No. And folks could look at the charts. I'm not going to read out more numbers because I already did that earlier. But basically, to your point, yeah, it's over the course of like a couple years where it's just like a little drop, like 10% here and there. And then all of a sudden you're at 40% down from where you were a couple years ago. And when you look at the graphs, it's like we're sort of accelerating and like there's volatility. And to your point, I guess the last 2 years, the market's been up like 20 some odd percent.
Back to back 20 plus percent years. Yeah.
Yeah. We think we're brilliant or whatever, but I mean, that is a little unusual. And usually after that, there's a little bit of a drop. And we're just, you know, look at the charts out there and you'll see this sort of thing.
Yeah. And I would, you know, people ask me, well, should I sell and go to cash? And then I'm like, well, then you're going to have to make a decision on when to get back in. But what I always just, you know, suggest to people the way they think about this is invest according to what your goal timeline is. So for me, for instance, I like to have a lot of cash for the next, you know, 5 or 10 years, just because I know I'm going to be spending money. I need income. That is, I pay myself a paycheck. I want to have that, you know, preserved and on the side and not take risk with it. But for goals that might be 10 years and longer, yeah, sure, I'm happy to have equities, even if they don't do anything for a period of time. But I don't want to be in a position where I own equities and I need to sell them at a point in time to pay myself my paycheck and subject that portion of the assets to volatility. So kind of align your investment time horizon with your goals.
Makes total sense. Okay. Very good. I think we covered everything pretty well. Did you have any other points, Mark?
I thought, oh yeah. What was Elizabeth's take again? What did she say?
She basically was like, she could invest, Jennifer could invest and just like withdraw money as time goes on. However, to your point, like we don't know what the market's going to do. It could be down 35%. There could be some few year recovery. And at that point, then you're kind of in trouble. And your solution, Mark, kind of addresses that. It limits the downside. And, you know, I just mentioned it to Elizabeth in passing, so she didn't think about it deeper. She's very smart. I think she would have come up with your same answer.
Well, I know she's very conservative. So I thought she would probably have a pretty conservative answer.
Yeah. And it's like, I like the idea of like buying, like giving up some return in order to get some freedom with your time or mental capacity. If, you know, it sounds like Jennifer had her own business 20 years, you know, it's like she's getting a little tired and burnt out. And it's like, want to take a little bit of a break. And that makes sense to me. So not all the returns are necessarily just the bottom line of like how much money you have.
Well, and that's why I think also when you get in this time frame, like for her, for example, if she's going to step away from work, you know, when we're in the accumulation phase, we're always talking about maximizing returns and having high percentage in equities and very little bonds and cash. And I'm kind of on the other side of that now. I have a lot of money in cash, not a huge percentage of the portfolio, but a number of years of kind of runway. And it's so much better to sleep at night. Like, I don't worry about where my paycheck is coming from for the next 5+ years. It just doesn't concern me. It's sitting in a money market account or treasury bills, and they're earning a decent return today, you know, 4%-ish. It's, in my mind, keeping up with inflation, which is the concern that anyone would have in that space. And it's just so much easier. So it doesn't have to be this all or nothing. Like, do I take this money and, you know, pay off the mortgage, or do I invest in this aggressively, you know, managed portfolio? There are other ways to kind of solve the puzzle in the middle.
Very good. All right. This is a great question. If people have comments out there, you know, do shoot me an email. I think this is
I would be curious to hear her response too to this as well. So maybe she'll send you an email and you can let me know what, what the response is.
Very good. And I want to plug your show, Mark. One thing you mentioned, the Berkshire Hathaway stock that you have a pretty cool episode on that topic, don't you?
I don't think I did an episode on Berkshire.
Didn't you talk about
it? I mean, occasionally I talk about it, but
yeah. I'll try to find the episode that I'm thinking about. I feel like there was a story about your mom and telling you about
that was way back when. Yeah. So yeah.
Well, don't spoil it. We'll link up to it. Yeah. But it's how you acquired your early shares. Like when did you first buy it?
98 or 99. Wow. That would be 1998 or 1999.
It was in the 1900s.
Yes.
Is when you first bought in.
Yeah. I know. Cool. Emma von Weiss. Have you had her on the show before?
No, I haven't. I know Emma.
Actually. Super smart. Anyway, you'll have to have her on the show. And she's always like, she was born in 2000. So she's like, oh, I wasn't born in the 1900s. Like you old people.
Yeah, that's rough. Yeah, I was like, I was out of college. No, I was still in college, but yeah, a full adult by then. All right. Well, we'll link up to your show in that specific episode. Like I said, it's a fun story about how you first got those shares. But what other stuff is coming up on your pod?
Well, basically what I do is I just talk about whatever's on my mind, hence the Mark's Money Mind moniker. And I am probably going to talk a little bit about what we talked about, where people are not necessarily paying attention to valuations as much as they maybe could or should. Because when you buy an index fund, you just are thinking about the index fund itself, but many people aren't kind of looking underneath the hood. And what is it that you're getting for your money? So I want to kind of dive into that a little bit.
Okay. Sounds like an advanced topic.
Maybe not. We'll see. Yeah. I try to make it cool. As simple as possible.
Very good. You're a good storyteller too. So yeah, we'll link up to that so people could check it out. And probably people will see you at various events if they're at a Camp Fi or economy or other stuff like that.
Camp Fi, Rocky Mountain Week 1 and 2 for sure.
Very cool.
That's definitely on the docket.
Thanks for joining me. It's always fun to catch up.
Yeah, it's always great to be here.
Thanks for listening to the show. That was the Mile High Five podcast, and I'm Doug Cunnington. If you dig the show, please do 3 things for us. Number 1, tell a friend, a family member, an enemy about the show. We really don't care who you tell. Maybe forward them a specific show that you know that they will like. It's the single most helpful thing that you can do to spread the word. It's like giving us a virtual high five, and actually we don't give high fives in person, so the virtual kind's pretty good. And more importantly, your friend or family member or even your enemy will appreciate the fact that you were thinking of them. Number 2, make sure you're following or subscribed on your podcast app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, YouTube, whatever you're using, and that way you won't miss a show. And number 3, please leave us a rating and review. We read them on the show occasionally, and you might hear yours out there on an upcoming episode. Quick disclaimer, this show is not financial or legal advice. I'd actually be surprised if it sounded like it. It's really just for entertainment, and that's at least what we're hoping for. But seriously, get advice from professionals. So we'll catch y'all next week. We usually keep our house like relatively clean-ish, but like over time, over a week or two, things just kind of get cluttered. So one trick that we have is we'll invite people over, and or like something will naturally pop up where people come over, and then that forces us to clean up a little bit more. So like, we knew you were coming over today, so we kind of cleaned up
for me.
We cleaned up a little bit, not that much. I cleaned up like we have a couple people coming over tonight, so we cleaned up a little bit, not too much for you. We were like, we haven't vacuumed yet, but yeah, we end up doing that. So I'm curious, are you like a messy person? You a clean person? What's your house look like?
I try to keep a pretty tidy house. The challenge is with my dog, who has, you know, dog hair that tends to go everywhere. I'm constantly now seeing it everywhere because it's a new house. So new to me, like the other house had darker floors, so you didn't see it as much. My floors are a little lighter in this house. So I'm like, I see it more often. I'm like, man, I got to run this vacuum more. I'm probably in the old house. I probably needed to run it, but I didn't know I needed to run it. So now I am trying to keep on top of it a little bit more, but I do keep like my counters clean and all that kind of stuff. But I do need to, and this prompted my thought train here is Mindy Jensen has a clean house cleaner that she recommended. And I said, oh yeah, I'm going to do that as soon as I get all the stuff in the house kind of done. And now it's done. So now I got to reach out to her and say, all right, we need to have you come. And I like a house cleaner coming like once a month. For me by myself, that's fine. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's on my agenda. I guess after this, maybe I have to make my phone call.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, I don't think Elizabeth and I like mind like some cleaning, but I think one thing that could be helpful is, yeah, once a month or two for someone to do like a deeper clean. And it, cause like we clean a little bit often.
Who cleans the shower? That's what I want to know.
We kind of trade it off.
Oh, okay. Cause yeah. I need either a good shower cleaning technique.
Right.
Or I usually just have someone do it.
Yeah. So it's a little, it's a little tough at times. So we have tile in there and then glass. Is that what yours is?
Yeah. Yeah.
So one thing that I got that did help a lot, cause like it has the normal, sort of basin, the white fiberglass, whatever it is. But I got like a brush drill attachment, and that made it much easier. So I have like a pretty powerful drill, so I could just like go through and clean the floor very effectively. Yeah. But yeah, it's like we trade it off and we have a different technique, so it's kind of good for us to switch off.
What about the glass? What do you do with the glass?
So I typically like a acid based whatever. So we use like vinegar with a little bit of soap in it.
Okay.
And we don't use any super special cleaners. However, I know there's like the film. We don't have particularly hard water around
here.
Yeah,
that's what we had in Crested Butte. It doesn't seem like it's too bad here.
Yeah, it's not nearly as bad, but it still will get some film on there. So occasionally I have used just a little bit of like Comet, or I think you could even use like baking soda, just a super light abrasive, because you don't want to like scratch the glass or whatever. Yeah. But it is a little tough to get that stuff off. But yeah, I think it's probably worthwhile for both of us to just have like a pro cleaner come in, and they have like right chemicals.
And they're so good at it. They just know what to do. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and they do it a lot faster than I would. So,
yeah.
And it's, but I don't mind running the vacuum and trying to keep things neat and tidy. And, you know, that doesn't bother me.
Yeah.
But I always find it funny that I clean for the cleaner. Yeah. I don't know if you do that. But it is like putting stuff away, taking everything off the counters to make it super fast for them.
Right. And I think, you know, that's a little thing. Like when people are coming over, even you, Mark, will clear off all the stuff that's on the counter and it just looks nicer. It's like there's some stuff we use all the time, so we leave it out. But like when folks are coming over, it's just like,
it's like the mail sitting there and this, whatever.
Like my desk, that's relatively clean over there. Mm-hmm. but there's a bunch of shit all over it. You should see it when it's messy. It looks like someone just dumped. Yeah. And it's all, you know, there's a method to the madness. Yeah. But how about that? What's your desk like?
Well, so my desk is very clean now because I just moved in, right?
Yeah.
So we'll see how it progresses over time, because in my other house, I had a really big desktop. So there were like these piles of things. And Katie was always like, what's with the piles? And I'm like, she's like, do you ever go through those? I was like, you know, I really don't. So I need to clear them off. And this time now, everything is all clean and clear. And hopefully it stays that way. We'll see. But yeah, now yeah. I even have like a bookshelf with books. And
yeah.
Yeah.
It is funny. There are piles over there. And I'm like, I'm going to definitely use that later. And then every now and then, I'm like, you know what? I'm not going to. I just throw it out.
Yeah.
So I am getting better. Or you know what? I'm not getting better. Just occasionally I throw stuff out. I'm like, okay, it's clear I'm not going to ever do anything with this piece of information. Yeah. And then you find post-it notes with just random stuff. I don't even know why I wrote it in the first place. It's crazy.